It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an author about the rich musical history behind a chair factory in Grafton, Wisconsin.
First, the Wisconsin survey shows that 48% of Wisconsinites polled support increasing fees like the gas tax or vehicle registration fees to pay for road construction and repair in the state. That's compared for 33% of survey responders who said Wisconsin should continue to borrow money to pay for transportation funding.
Craig Thompson's with us now to talk about some of the options being considered when it comes to funding road construction and repair here in the state. He's the executive director of the Transportation Development Association. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, to put some of this in context, from where you're sitting, how bad are the roads in Wisconsin? How much need is there for maintenance and construction here in the state?
Well, you know, Wisconsin, historically, we've done a pretty good job, but we do have more and more of our, you know, both city, town, county roads, and then some of our state roads that are getting in worse condition. Right now, according to engineers, we've got about 21% of our roads that are in poor or worse condition, and we've got about 12,000 bridges in the state that are considered structurally deficient. So, it's getting to be a serious situation.
Now, as things stand currently, how do we pay for our roads? Where does the money come from?
Well, in Wisconsin, about a quarter of our transportation money comes from the federal government. The rest of it is a combination of gas tax revenues, vehicle registration fee revenues, and bonding.
And how much of a shortfall do we have taking those sources, comparing them to the need? How short are we on money?
Well, we're significantly short. The annual amount is about $3.6 billion for the budget, and we're probably about $600 million short per year, or about $1.2 billion over the biennium.
So a lot of people, politicians and others, talking about a need for more money, but it seems like there's a long list of possible ideas, bonding, increasing gas tax, user fees, trying to get a toll road down the road. And one thing they all have in common is most people dislike those ideas. How hard is it to get a consensus on a way to pay for roads?
Well, you know, it's difficult, but I think we are seeing in the poll that you're referencing, we're watching in other states as well. I think more and more people are coming to the idea that they would rather pay as we go rather than, you know, an over-reliance on bonding. There's an appropriate level of bonding for major capital projects like that, but if you simply rely on bonding to fund all of the projects and you don't increase the revenue stream, then you end up getting eaten up by debt service. And I think we're getting close to that, and what the governor recommended, which was to significantly put more on bonding, we felt went way too far down that route. So I think what we're seeing is some people are coming to the realization that some very modest fee increases is probably a better way to go.
Talking to Craig Thompson with the Transportation Development Association, looking at how we pay for our roads in Wisconsin, linked to the results from the new Wisconsin survey. And Craig, that survey, as we mentioned, 48% of respondents said they'd support, as a way to pay for roads, some kind of increased fees to fund transportation. What are the options? What kind of fees are being kicked around that we might increase to pay for roads?
Well, our current revenue stream is basically the registration fees we pay when we register our car, which is right now $75 a year, which is, you know, quite a bit lower than any of our neighbors. And then there's our state gas tax, which is in 30.9 cents a gallon. So those are really the two revenue streams that are on the books right now.
And looking at the gas tax, people have pointed to this as a problem. If we're paying for by the gallon, and our cars are getting better gas mileage, or maybe even eventually using no gas, there are fewer gallons being used, less money coming in, even though the roads are being used just as much. Is that being seen as maybe not a viable way to look for our future funding needs for transportation?
Well, you know, I think, Rob, on one hand, a lot of folks have looked at eventually transitioning. You know, the gas tax has always been viewed as a user fee, and eventually, is hopefully we continue to keep getting either, you know, more fuel efficient or more hybrids and more electrics, which would be a great thing. Eventually, that may be unsustainable. But I think in the short term, as you said, if we're getting better gas mileage, so we are paying less in gas tax, but That in the short term can be addressed by adjusting the gas tax so that we pay, you know, the same amount at least as we used to be paying.
Now, politicians don't always like to have a vote to increase a tax, gas or otherwise, on their resume come election time. Do you think that there's the political will there to do something like that?
Well, I think that's the question right now. What we're seeing in many other states, including red states, is that they have decided. Iowa just increased their gas tax 10 cents within the last month here. South Dakota just increased theirs. Idaho, Utah, Georgia, Wyoming, quite a few states have about 14 states in the last year or two have increased their gas tax or some version of that. So, you know, every state's different. And it wouldn't have to be the gas tax. They could look at registration fees or others. But to either put it off ends up increasing the cost, or to simply put more on borrowing, you know, increases the cost in the form of debt service.
Now, for that vehicle registration fee, you just mentioned that as an option. How big an increase could there be before people have sticker shock and aren't happy about a big jump in that fee?
You know, that's all a matter of, I think, perception and what. One of the reasons we do have a low registration fee and we've gone more on the gas tax is because, you know, registration fees only impact people that live in Wisconsin, whereas a gas tax, you get, you know, motorists that are traveling through Wisconsin, they pay that as well. So we have gone more on that. But our neighbors, you know, like Iowa and Minnesota, for example, and Michigan, have some sort of value-based fee. So like in Iowa, you pay 1% of the value of your car plus some weight factor. So if you buy a $25,000 car, then it's a $250 fee. It's all what people's expectations are and what they're comfortable with.
Now, speaking of neighbors, our neighbors to the south have a solution, toll roads that a lot of Wisconsinites, based on their experience driving in Illinois, haven't historically liked. But there maybe is some growing, people are warming to that idea in certain circumstances. The Wisconsin Policy Research Institute has been calling for toll roads or exploring the option for a long time. Is that an option short term? Is it an option long term in Wisconsin?
Well, short term, it really isn't, because right now there's a federal prohibition on tolling existing interstate miles, which dates back to when the federal government provided states with the money for the freeway system. Now, a lot of states are making the argument that, these interstates reached 50 years old a while ago and are at the end of their life and are in the process of being rebuilt, as we're seeing right now, you know, with the Zoo Interchange and the Marquette Interchange and some areas of I-94. And so they feel that argument no longer holds, and if the federal government isn't going to come up with additional funds, that they should allow states to be able to toll. But as of right now, that prohibition still stands. So, you know, for example, for this upcoming budget, that's really not an option that's on the table.
Now, we've been talking about the getting money here, the tax and revenue side. Spending-wise, some people have said too much is going toward big projects in southeastern Wisconsin in particular, at the expense of local roads in northern Wisconsin and elsewhere. Do you see that as a problem?
Well, you know, I just was with the cities, towns, and counties talking about a lot of this, and what they view as the problem more is our reliance on bonding, because that money does not get down to them, and so the funding for the locals has gone down, but a lot of these big projects that we've talked about, the counties association and towns association and league of municipalities, they say they recognize that in the process of rebuilding the zoo, for example, that you have to do it in a way that is going to last for the next 50 years. So I think they're looking at the lack of ongoing revenue being the bigger problem for funding of locals than those projects.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association, with us to discuss the Wisconsin survey results on transportation funding options here in Wisconsin.
From 1917 to 1935, some of the most influential blues records were produced in Grafton, Wisconsin, in a building that housed a chair factory. Paramount Records was responsible for producing music for many blues legends, including Blind Lemon Jefferson and Ma Rainey, who we're hearing right now.
This weekend, the UW-Madison is holding a 3-day event celebrating the legacy of Paramount Records with music, lectures, and workshops that are free and open to the public.
And joining us now to tell us more about the event and Paramount Records is Amanda Petrusich, music journalist and author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Amanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, in shorthand, how did this old chair factory in Grafton became a music label?
Sure. It's a really incredible, sort of strange American story, very serendipitous in a way. But Paramount Records began as a subsidiary of the Wisconsin Chair Company, which was a furniture company that began making phonograph cabinets under contract for Thomas Edison. And at a certain point, they decided it would make kind of smart business sense to make records to go along with the pieces of furniture that they were producing to host, to hold turntables. And so, you know, the records were really an afterthought. It was never kind of the main idea or the main objective of the WCC to record blues musicians, but they started this label called Paramount, which cast a very wide net beginning in the 1920s when they launched a race record series. And via talent scouts and a few sort of fortunate accidents, ended up accidentally recording some of what I believe to be the greatest blues performances in history.
And give us a taste of some of the artists and the influence that this Paramount label had.
Sure. I mean, the influence is really extraordinary. I mean, they recorded folks like Charlie Patton and Blind Lemon Jefferson, and then also people like Skip James. And one of my favorite Paramount records is by a singer named Gishi Wiley, who recorded just a handful of sides for Paramount in the late 1920s, and about which we know very little other than her surviving records, which are extraordinarily rare and collectible. But she came up from Natchez, Mississippi via a talent scout and recorded six songs for the label, my favorite of which is a song called Last Kind Word Blues. But those songs, I mean, became influential documents of the kind of blues canon and, you know, later inspired folks, you know, like Keith Richards or Eric Clapton or the sort of second wave of rock and roll bands were hugely influenced by those records that were recorded here in Wisconsin.
What did Paramount do that made these recordings so great? Was it the artists that they found, or was it something about the way they approached it?
It's sort of the million-dollar question with Paramount. It's, you know, in many ways, it just feels like this thing that sort of happened by accident. I mean, the records themselves actually sound pretty terrible. They 78s are made of a shellac compound that has a lot of clay and dirt and other things in it, and they weren't using a great mix. Collectors and certainly sound archivists are kind of constantly griping about the relative shoddiness of Paramount pressings. And then even the recording studio that they built in Grafton to host performers who came up mostly from the South was also not state of the art. But they did have some really good talent scouts that were working for the company. But really, by and large, what happened there is sort of, it feels almost like a mystical occurrence. It's, you kind of can't make heads or tails of it, of how this sort of funny little label ended up, you know, being inadvertently responsible for these really tremendous recordings.
Talking to Amanda Petrusich about a Wisconsin furniture company that became a preeminent blues label for a while here in the state and around the nation. Now, shoddy or not, these things became collector's items, so much so that at least one person has gone scuba diving in the Wisconsin River to find them. That was you. Tell us how that came to be.
Sure. Well, so when the company went under during the Great Depression, for years these sort of rumors persisted that the employees were so disgruntled and so disappointed and kind of devastated that they'd lost their jobs. They were angry, so they just hurled all the dead stock. So the remaining Paramount records that had been pressed but had not yet been sent to distributors just frisbeed them into the Milwaukee River. And so for years collectors have been saying that that is in part why Paramount records are now so rare and so coveted and so expensive and so impossible to find is because they all got kind of tossed into a watery mass grave. And so when I heard that story, I was just beginning the kind of work, the research and reporting of my book, and I was catching the bug a little bit too. I mean, I'm a big music fan and I'd collected LPs for many years, but 78s were sort of new to me. And I was spending all this time with these collectors who had these incredible collections. And I felt a little bit like, oh God, I'm coming to this too late. I want these records. I can't find them anywhere. I can't afford them. And when I heard that story, I thought, like, well, okay, maybe I'm just sort of young and dumb enough to try this. And maybe it would be a way to, you know, both get closer to the label and the place where these records that mean so much to me were made. And also I was hoping I could just find some sort of evidence of what had happened there.
And what did you find down there?
Well, I have to say the Milwaukee River is not a great place to scuba dive. It's very muddy. It's very shallow in that particular stretch of Grafton. I sort of flailed around in the water for a day. I found some pieces that were later were fairly sure were part of the old pressing plant, but I was not able, unfortunately, to come up with any records, which I think maybe from the start I knew it was sort of a fool's errand, but it felt like a kind of initiation in a way, like a thing I had to do.
Well, diving or not, what got you into collecting these old 78 RPM records like the ones from Paramount Records in Wisconsin?
Well, I was a fan of a lot of the music, pre-war American vernacular music, country blues, hillbilly country, gospel music. I was, you know, loved that stuff, and I had listened to it primarily on digital reissues or LP reissues. And it wasn't until I was reporting a story for Spin Magazine about the commercial resurgence of vinyl records. A bunch of artists were reissuing their whole back catalogs on vinyl. And I was talking to a source who told me, vinyl collectors are obsessive, record collectors of LPs are really interesting, but if you want to talk to someone who's completely insane, find a 78 collector. So I did that. I met a collector in New York who I later profiled for the New York Times and was able to hear a 78 played in front of me for the first time and found it to be transformative.
Well, vinyl sales are on the up, upswing. Record Store Day keeps getting more popular. What is it about vinyl, collecting records, that you think is so attractive to people? Why is it booming right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think in part, you know, the tactile experience of having something in your hands, you know, the ritual of playing it. I think in our sort of increasingly fragmented and accelerated and virtual world, there's something really satisfying and sort of anchoring about that. I also think they sound really, really great. If you're used to listening to MP3s through, you know, kind of crappy earbuds, listening to a record played on a proper stereo can be really revelatory. And I think people just like to, you know, to have a collection that they can say, you know, this says a little something about who I am.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Amanda Petrosich, music journalist, the author of Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records.
Might be crawling in my room. And some pretty mama had better come in. Get this black steak soon.
For many Americans, there's a growing feeling that the current political system isn't working for them. Republicans and Democrats bicker, gridlock ensues, a lot of money gets poured into elections with little change to show for it. Many people are left wondering, are we really any better off?
Well, in response to some of those concerns, a new political movement has launched in Wisconsin and is looking to shake up the status quo, not as a third party, but rather as a movement that works within the two-party system to try and put ordinary people back in charge.
Mike McCabe joins us now. He's the longtime executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, now the founder of Blue Jean Nation, which officially launched here in Wisconsin earlier this month. Mike, thanks for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I summed up some of the common criticisms of the way government works in the state, in the nation. As you see it, though, what is wrong with politics today?
I think the central problem is that most people sense that government is working for a few at the expense of the many, and that elected officials are ceaselessly catering to a privileged few and are ignoring the voices of most people. And so your average citizen feels as though their vote doesn't matter much and their voice isn't being heard, their interests aren't being represented. So many people are feeling politically homeless. And that's a condition that, you know, that is not only something that you pick up on just through observation, talking to people, but it shows up in Gallup polling and Pew Research. The percentage of Americans who refuse to identify as either Democrats or Republicans is at its highest level in three quarters of a century.
Now, you're trying to fill that gap in some ways, as I understand it, with this Blue Jean Nation project. So what's it all about? How are you trying to tackle this problem?
This is about trying to pull people together to create a force strong enough to compel the major parties, or at least one of them, to reconnect with the people in a meaningful way and change their ways. It's been done before. Past generations were successful working within a two-party system in making change. Landscape-altering change has come to our country on multiple occasions. It was plain people who did it, ordinary citizens who banded together. And I think the conditions are such that such an effort is needed again, because so many people are feeling disillusioned and alienated from the major parties and from the political system in general. The level of dissatisfaction is sort of off the charts, and that means that it's time for citizens to do again what has been done successfully in the past.
So some people look at the two-party system, say the two parties are the problem, we need a third party. Why not pursue that avenue?
Well, a lot of people do long for a third party or a fourth or a fifth. The problem is that America has a two-party system. We're not a parliamentary democracy. We don't have a system where competing factions can join forces and form coalition governments. We don't have any of the mechanisms that allow third parties to effectively compete in our elections and vie for real political power. In fact, we've got a system that actively discriminates against third-party creation or formation. And so we start with the realization that the ranks of the politically homeless are large, that people are feeling they're feeling left out, they're feeling let down. But we also start with the realization that we have a two-party system and that we have to work within that system to make change and take some cues from past generations who were successfully able to do just that.
I wanted to ask about that. Are you modeling this somewhat on the progressive movement where you had progressive Democrats and progressive Republicans as almost factions within those two parties?
Well, you know, even the birth of the Republican Party came at a time when the two major parties were the Democrats and the Whigs, and both were basically pro-slavery. There was a growing abolitionist movement. People were feeling politically homeless. They banded together and they shed old labels and they fashioned themselves a new identity. They started calling themselves Republicans. A little over a generation later, you had the progressive movement, and that ended up infiltrating both major parties and transforming both of those major parties. You didn't see the extinction of a major party the way you did with the Whig Party back at the birth of the Republican Party, but you had both major parties adapting to this new progressive movement. It's happened on multiple occasions. Most recently, it really has happened within the Republican Party with the Tea Party movement. That party has been significantly transformed. And the Tea Party movement's not a party at all. It's a brand that has been used to take over the Republican Party and make that party a lot more subservient to the interests of those who hatched the Tea Party movement. So this has happened on multiple occasions. What is missing for so many people is an opportunity to feel like they're authentically being represented by the major parties, and that's a condition that I think cries out for some citizen innovation, and we're trying to do our part here with Blue Jean Nation to give people a vehicle for doing just that.
Talk to Mike McCabe about his project Blue Jean Nation, trying to provide a home for the politically homeless, he says, overcome political dissatisfaction and make government more serviceable to the rank and file American. So suppose somebody out there is listening and says, yeah, that's me. I'm politically homeless. Don't like what the parties are doing. I don't feel like my interests are being met. But so what? How are you going to help me connect with politics? What are you going to do on a practical level?
This is really about helping people pull together at a neighborhood level, for starters. And so, you know, if we're really going to create a Blue Jean Nation, we have to have Blue Jean neighborhoods. We have to have Blue Jean communities and Blue Jean counties. We have to have people in their own backyard pulling together, shedding some old labels, accepting a new identity or fashioning a new identity for themselves, and then using that to try to drive change in the political process. Out of that local organization, that neighborhood-level organization, naturally people will emerge who will be right to be candidates for school board or for city council or county board, eventually state legislature or Congress. And that, when a new breed comes on the political scene and starts to offer itself up as a real alternative within the two-party system, that's what compels major parties to adapt. They either risk losing large numbers of voters to these kinds of citizen insurgencies, or they adapt. They change their ways. And it's happened before. In fact, it's happened many times throughout the course of our country's history. And every time it's happened, you had conditions like today where so many people were feeling alienated from the major parties. They were effectively politically homeless. And then the first step that they took was to shed old labels and kind of do away with the old political vocabulary that was failing them and come up with a new identity for themselves and use that new brand, if you will, as the Tea Party did, to compel change.
Well, I want to talk about that political language a bit. And first, maybe an obvious question, what's the significance of blue jean here, blue jeans?
Well, it's a symbol that is probably as uniting a symbol as you can think of in American society. Everybody's got them. Young people wear them. Old people wear them. People on both coasts, in the North, the South. You can wear them to school now. You never used to be able to do that. And you can wear them to church now, and you never used to be able to do that. Blue jeans are everywhere. And when you think about things that we all have in common, that's about as common a symbol as you can come up with. It also, I think, is a symbol that does a great job of distinguishing what I call commoners, plain people, from the suits on Wall Street or on K Street where all the lobbyists hang out, or the suits on Capitol Hill that are sort of lording over us. It distinguishes the people who are feeling politically homeless from those who are being catered to, the politically privileged. This is an effort, above all else, aimed at fighting political privilege.
And one question you wrote in a recent blog post, a question you get a lot. Okay, this is a reform movement. Is this a liberal reform movement or a conservative reform movement? That's another one of those language issues you want to tackle.
Yeah, you know, those labels are failing us. They are actually dividing people who have an awful lot in common. And they're dividing people who could and should be united simply because people are wearing these labels. Those words don't mean what they used to mean. The word liberal or conservative, they don't mean what they used to mean. They don't even mean what the dictionary says they mean today. It is baggage that people carry, whether they deserve to or not. Those labels load baggage onto people that ends up turning them into enemies in the eyes of people who could be their allies. And when political language has failed Americans before, people got creative and they did away with those labels and they came up with new vocabulary to describe themselves. We desperately need to do that now because there are an awful lot of people who see themselves as enemies. And when you talk to them, they actually have an awful lot of common ground. They agree on way more than they've been trained to think that they do.
Talking right now with Mike McCabe about the new political movement, Blue Jean Nation. He says it's time to put politics back in the hands of regular people, says it's possible to work within the two-party system to make that happen. What do you think? Give a call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Mike McCabe, founder of Blue Jean Nation, a political movement launched here in Wisconsin earlier this month. Their goal, putting regular folks back in charge of politics. You can call in at 800-642-1234. What kind of change are you looking for? Do you think something can be done in the current two-party system? Do you feel politically homeless, unrepresented by the major parties? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Get to your calls in just a moment. But before we do, Mike, I mean, is there a faulty premise here? I mean, is that there's a lot of people feeling disconnected from the parties for similar enough reasons that they can unite? Or is it some people think all the parties are too conservative for them or too liberal, or they all have different single issue things that the parties don't meet their needs? Is this a chaos that you can't really unite in one more or less similar direction?
I think one of the common threads that runs through the disillusionment, and it runs across the political spectrum, is the idea that government is not working for all the people. It's working for a select few, a privileged few. And that they're taking their cues from big donors and the lobbyists, and they're not representing the people. That is a core concern that is unifying.
Let's get to our callers. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I must tell you, I find your speaker quite refreshing, and I find it difficult a lot of times that when people talk about conservative or liberal or labels, that there are actually several definite different areas of concern, such as social policy versus tax policy and fiscal policy versus, you know, the size of government type policy. People who would look at how the government is working, say, for a single issue like abortion, when there is really not going to be any change, are then electing policy that it doesn't necessarily serve their interests, such as if you choose a certain person because of one issue, how they vote on the other issues become confusing and muddled, and people are unsatisfied.
Charlie, thanks for the call. So because we've lumped this over here into conservative, this over here into liberal, and a party to match, that a lot of people feel like their needs aren't being met, he says.
Well, these words are failing us. The truth is, people ask me, are you a liberal or a conservative? The honest answer is that I'm a mutt. I'm like most normal people. Normal people aren't purebreds. They're not 100% liberal or 100% conservative. They're a mixture based on what issues you're talking about. People are complicated. And the truth is, most of us are mutts. But in the political world, they pass themselves off as purebreds. And they say that they're 100% this or 100% that. And I think that's another way that these labels are now failing us. And it's time to do some innovating in that regard.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I totally disagree with your speaker. There's been a corporate conservative takeover revolutionizing Wisconsin politics, starting with the Gableman Supreme Court judicial race through last election, in which, with the help of Citizens United and millions of dollars of out-of-state money, has destroyed unions in this state, has destroyed, created an unequal playing field, and now with the 2010 census and the complete gerrymandering of all the political districts in the state of Wisconsin, one political party fights with one hand tied behind its back. People know the values of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but there is an overwhelming corrupt financial advantage for the Republican Party, where they're even stopping the John Doe investigation and in front of Supreme Court justices who took money from the Wisconsin Club for Growth and will not recuse themselves.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. So he's saying by trying to elide, I guess, these differences, you're ignoring real differences that he says are making a difference in the state for the worse from his perspective.
One of the underlying premises of Blue Jean Nation is that we're at a moment where both major parties are failing us, and they're failing us in different ways. I'm not one of those people who believes the two parties are the same. They're very different, but they're failing us. One of the things I've said frequently is that we've got one party that's scary and another that's scared. And the funny thing about that line is I've used it in every imaginable kind of audience, with every kind of audience. And I've yet to have anybody say which one is which. People instinctively understand what I'm talking about when I say that we've got one party that's scary and another that's scared. And people are sort of fed up with one party let down by the other. They're frustrated, and that's the condition that I describe as being politically homeless. And if we can drive change within one major party, that's going to make the other party have to adapt or adjust. And so I think we start from that premise that we've got both major parties failing us at the moment, and citizens need to take matters into their own hands to right that wrong.
Talking to Mike McCabe about his Blue Jean Nation project. He's the founder of it, an effort to provide a home for the politically homeless, he says, people who aren't feeling represented by either major party or by elected government. Before we get back to callers at 800-642-1234, does this project start off with a set of policy agendas or platforms on issues, or is this something you want to build from people who join up at the ground up?
Well, people can go to BlueJeanNation.com, our website. We list five aims, and really those aims can even be distilled down to two central thrusts. And one is really trying to fight political privilege, and the other is to deal with the things like the growing income and wealth inequality in America and the fact that we're really growing apart as a society rather than growing together as we did for decades, after World War II in particular. But we've got five aims, and it really does boil down to taking on the extent to which the politically privileged are running our government and ordinary people are left out in the cold. And so I invite people to go to that website and take a look at the values that are embedded in this attempt to get citizens back in the driver's seat of our government at a time when both parties are failing us.
Back to our callers now with Dwayne in Middleton. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. First off, I want to say I have a lot of respect for Mike McCabe and all the things he's done over the years, but I do disagree on this issue because you're talking about reforming broken system. I mean, both of the political parties, we talk about how much they don't work and how much they fight against each other and how they can't get anything done. But then you look at a policy like the National Defense Authorization Act, which had a clause in it which said that the United States government can indefinitely detain American citizens without trial or charge, voted for by both Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin. So, you know, when you got really horrible policies come up for a vote, Democrats and Republicans come together, and I just think we need to completely abolish the Democrats and the Republicans. I don't even know if there's any faith in the electoral system anymore, but if the electoral system's going to work at all, I think then at least we have to promote the Green Party and even the Libertarian Party, because
I want to get Mike in to respond to that. Beyond hope, he says, effectively, the Democrats and Republicans.
Well, you know, America and our democracy has faced huge threats before. Conditions have been even worse than they are today at other points in our nation's history. And citizens found the capacity to make the political system change, to reconnect with ordinary people. I refuse to believe that there's something different about us now or something wrong with us that makes us less capable of change than past generations were. In a lot of ways, we've got much more going for us than past generations did. And they were able to make change within a two-party system. I have great faith that we can do that again. But I think the caller's comments underscore the extent to which people get it. They understand what a crisis we face and how sick our political system has really become. So if people are content with the major parties as they are, we pose no threat to the major parties. If I'm right, and people are as deeply disturbed and disillusioned with the current state of our political system, then we as citizens need to take that and work to put that to use and make something better and different.
Do you worry that people are so disillusioned, maybe cynical, that not only will they reject the parties, the two major parties, but political participation at all, including an effort like yours?
Powerlessness is rampant. People are feeling, you know, it's not apathy that I encounter. People care deeply. It's not that they don't care, but they're feeling very powerless. What we're trying to do with Blue Jean Nation is give people a reason to regain their faith in their own capacity to have political influence.
You know, from the perspective of somebody in a party, they may be hearing this thinking, wait, we have firmly held ideological beliefs. Yeah, there's some money behind them, but these are things we hold dear, we think are important. You know, we're just as valid as the thing you're trying to do, Mike.
Oh, and again, if people are satisfied with either the Democrats or the Republicans today, what I would say is I'm happy for you. I'm happy that you have a political home, that you have that you belong to a household that you want to live in. Problem is that so many Americans now don't feel comfortable in either of those households. They're really sickened by what's going on in our political system. So we're trying to do something about that.
Briefly, Mike, looking maybe 5 years ahead, what does success look like at that stage for Blue Jean Nation?
It totally depends on how the parties react. Do they look at how people are feeling? Do they respond to the frustration among common folks and change their ways? Or do they dig in their heels and do nothing? Where this will go in the future totally depends on how the major parties respond to this crisis.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mike McCabe. He's the founder of the new political movement started here in Wisconsin, Blue Jean Nation.